This episode's a conversation I recorded with another local bud, Jamie Sparling, back at my home in Squamish. Jamie's a little bit older than me, but Jamie is a super interesting guy because he went through the whole process of trying to make it as a professional road cyclist growing up in Alberta, moving eventually to Europe to race in Europe professionally, deciding it wasn't really for him, had an option to continue doing it, but decided to walk away from road racing in order to explore other avenues in his life. Jamie moved on from road racing, of course, still rides his bike, but now when it's pouring rain outside, we have the ongoing joke that I'm getting out and having to ride through the rain in the valley around Squamish and freeze my butt off while he's grabbing his skis because he knows it's dumping snow up in the mountains. Jamie's an all-round mountain man, does all kinds of crazy sports. He has stories of him. He's the kind of guy that goes out and bags peaks that would take most people an entire weekend to do. He goes out, gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning, grabs his headlamp, and gets it done to get it done before he has to be at the office now because he has a normal job. Jamie's also the kind of guy that'll go run up another mountain after work, camp out that night, and then run back down and then be at the office the following day. Jamie's got so many cool stories, including shooting himself in the face with bear spray at the beginning of one trip and all kinds of other fun ones, as well as some of the ridiculous stuff that he did to try to get faster, some of the things that aren't super healthy, starving himself, and just some of the ridiculous training things he did to try to make the cycling dream come true. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Jamie.
Okay, so this time we got another mountain man story coming up. So I'm here now at my place in Squamish with Jamie Sparling, local mountain man. Jamie, how old are you?
I'm 35.
35. So when I look at you, I'm really interested in your story because I kind of see what you're doing and the path you've gone down is almost like looking into the future of mine, because I think you have it so cool. Is you went down the pro cycling life. You went down and you chased the pro cycling dream. You went to Europe. You had it. You did everything that I've done so far. But now, like, the way I see you transitioning in the life is you're living the mountain man life, and all the stuff that I want to do, like when it's snowing and it's just nuking out, like today the weather, we have like a foot of snow outside, and it's like, oh man, I got to get on the trainer, and I'm just like, oh, Jamie doesn't have to get on the trainer. Jamie can go skiing or something like that.
Yeah, well, you're on your trainer. I'm like looking at Spot WX or all the weather forecasting, figuring out where I'm going to go skiing
yeah,
this weekend.
Well, that's the thing is, I think literally I check the Weather Network app more than anything else on my phone. So, Jamie, why don't you give us a little background here? So we're going to get into some of the cooler stories later, but why don't you give us a bit of a background in your cycling brand? Like, how'd you get into cycling?
Yeah, so I started when I was about, I started mountain biking when I was like 11, because mountain biking, I grew up in Calgary, and I lived really close to a provincial park that had single track trails, and I loved to ride the single track. And so, you know, I ended up getting a half decent mountain bike and just cruised around, met a couple friends that were into mountain biking, and then, you know, much to the dismay of my father, I quit hockey and I joined this cycling program in Calgary that was based at the University of Calgary, that was at the time run by Dan Prue, who's now the head mountain bike coach for the CCA. And so he ran this program, and it was, you know, I was 14, I think, at the time when I joined this thing. And sort of the idea was to develop cyclists, but not necessarily specialized at a young age. It was sort of, okay, you're into mountain biking, but like, how do you like the velodrome? How are you on the road bike? You know, where can we kind of see some potential and try to have fun with it along the way? And so, you know, as I kind of grew from 14, 15 to 16 to 17, I realized that road biking was really, you know, what I liked. And, you know, that's kind of what got me into it. You know, it wasn't until I was like 23, 24, 25 that I realized that I may have like the ability to, you know, at least like see the world on someone else's dime and like get paid a little bit of money to do it. But, you know, that was the foundation, was starting in Calgary, like doing, you know, super grassroots races, you know, hanging out with your friends, going on road trips, much how it starts for most kind of junior level cyclists.
So when did it start to become like, when did you start to realize, you know what, I actually want to chase this as the dream? Like, when did you get like the Olympic dream bug, the Tour de France? You were thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to win the yellow jersey at the Tour or whatever. When did that start happening?
Well, yeah, that was always sort of there. You know, I was just like, yeah, I was a super late bloomer, and I was very, I had to be quite persistent. You know, it wasn't until I was like probably 24 that I won even my first local like Cat One race, you know, and like looking back at that now, it's such a peanuts thing. Like a Cat One Alberta or Cat One BC race is just like, it's like a big fish in a small pond kind of thing. But once you sort of got that taste of that little victory, say, okay, well maybe like, let's see if I can do this more often. And then maybe let's see if I can do this at the next level up. And so, you know, it took me 10 years to get from 14 years old to maybe 24 years old where I was able to do that. But then from 24 to 25 to 26, it's almost like I started riding the curve a little bit more where, you know, I could, you know, get on a UCI podium or, you know, win like a bigger US race kind of thing, you know, bigger in quotations mark, but bigger than a BC Cup, sort of level race. And it was sort of like a progression like that. And, yeah, that's where, when I kind of decided, well, I always wanted it, but when I finally was able to at least sort of break into that, you know, that next level.
Okay. And so because you came to the sport a little bit later that way, and let's say you like kind of miss the pipeline for the sport, as far as, you know, you get juniors picked up to take the best juniors, national team, and then it's pretty straightforward that way. Because you came into a little bit later and missed that program, you have to be more independent and kind of figure it out on your own. And there's a lot more grinding and hustling on the side, finding your own funding, sponsors, living on people's couch. You know, the guy where you probably have a bicycle that costs more than some people's cars, but you basically are homeless just trying to put all the money into the bike. And so, are there any kind of stories, like just crazy stories that you can think of when you're just trying to make this work? Like, you know what, this is my plan A, this is what I'm doing right now, and I don't care. Is there a story that stands out that you can think of as far as just like, I'm going to make this work?
Yeah, I mean, I really did. I mean, I was doing university a lot of the time too. And, you know, like you work jobs where, you know, when you're 22 or 23, they're quite lucrative. You know, I have a business background and I'm working in an investment bank as like a co-op student. And you're seeing like, whoa, I could, you know, I can do this for a living and maybe, you know, start making some big coin and everything. But then you just throw that all out the window, and then you're living in I'm living in a house with like six of my, Rob Britton, Nick Hamilton, like all this generation of Victoria. We had a cat named Toby, you know, and it's just like the most ghetto setup ever. That's like just the best. And we're driving around to all the races, and I don't know if it was like the third or the fourth generation of Nick's parents, like Plymouth Voyager minivan that Nick has somehow inherited, and you're just like cramming all the bikes into the back of this thing, and you're driving all over Oregon, or you're driving all over, like, I don't know, Washington, chasing these races. And we were like, it was sweet because you get all this, like, all your bonds are like strengthened because you're having some success, and you know, the struggle is really, you're trying to risk your life going around the last corner to win a $50 preem to you know pay the rent or buy some food or whatever. I mean, it was like, you know, times where, yeah, it wasn't, you always kind of have a bit of a safety net because we're, you know, we like live in Canada, which is, you know, such a great country where you have, you know, you're not gonna, it's a first world country where, you know, you're not trying to provide for your family by racing your bike, but at least you're still, you know, you're still, there's pressure there in terms of like, how are you going to eat kind of thing? Like, how are you going to buy like a, you know, what quality of food are you going to eat?
Sure.
Are you going to go eat at Subway, or are you going to, you know, go cook yourself up a good meal?
Okay. And so you did do school. You did go to university.
Yeah. Yeah. I was pretty fortunate. I mean, really, like, I did like a 12-year undergrad, I think. So I did a business degree over while racing. So you take three courses here, four courses there, do a co-op job.
Okay.
You know, every once in a while, which is pretty sweet because, you know, you could do a co-op job in the fall, and then you know, you make a bunch of money, and then then you just like leave. I like, you'd go to Hawaii, or I'd go to California, or I'd go to whatever for the winter time. So not like you, a little more soft.
So, where's the best place you've ever been to train then? Where's anywhere in the world you can ride a bike for your training? Where would you go?
I have thought about it whatever ranked, and I'd say my favorite place to ride a bike is Hawaii. I mean, it's so temperate. There's so much good, like, there's so many different, like geographical zones. Like, you know, you can ride through, like, weird, like, I've done a ride that starts, you know, where you see surfers, and then you're like, and then the same ride I've seen snowboarders at the top of Mauna Kea, which is crazy, you know, and like, I don't think there's anywhere else in the world where you can kind of get that diversity. So that'd be number one. Mallorca or Girona, I'd say, is like number two in Spain. It's like super awesome cycling culture. And then California is just so much variety there too. So
in California, where in California?
Oh, like Santa Rosa area, I'd say is probably my favorite place to ride. It's pretty, I mean, a lot of pros down there, and it's for a good reason.
And which island in Hawaii?
Big Island.
Big Island.
Big Island, for sure. Yeah, I've never ridden on any other one, so I can't really. But I went there for 4 months one winter.
With 4 months. Buddy
Dan. Oh, yeah, it was awesome.
How did you swing that?
Well, I had a pretty good co-op job before I went there. But we actually also had a friend who was going to University of Hawaii in Hilo. And she had like an extra room that my buddy and I could stay in. So we paid her barely anything in rent. And like we cooked some meals and stuff, like helped out around the place. And then we were just riding in Hawaii.
Hey, you want some of my oatmeal?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was awesome. It was like, yeah, I don't even remember. It was like $700 for a flight. And that was kind of it. And even when you're there, like when you think of Hawaii, you think of super expensive, ritzy tourist type stuff. But the east side of the Big Island is like pretty like modest, and there's a lot of farmers markets, and yeah, it's pretty doable. Like it was a lot of like cool roads there also. I mean, not a ton of variety. Like you sort of end up doing the same sort of routes, but I mean whatever. Like a 10, you're doing a 10 out of 10 ride every time, which is, you know.
I mean, that's definitely still a bucket list item for me, but again, so hopefully I'm looking into the future more. But
yeah,
so cyclists, you know, we're creatures of routine and efficiency, and it translates into everything else we do. So I think other than professional drivers, cyclists are the best drivers. Like other than like an F1 driver, someone that drives professionally, we're the best drivers, whether it's just like efficiency. And then even you're so routine and you're so built into it. You get up, you train, you do all this. Another. And so most of us, it's like you have your go-to breakfast or whatever. Like everyone makes the same oatmeal that they've had every single morning for the last 4 years or so. Was that ever you? And I'm wondering now, do you keep any of those habits, or do you change it up and now you kind of eat whatever you want? Like, did you have your go-to meal that you went to every single morning training, or maybe it was dinner or something else, and did you keep it?
Yeah, I did. I definitely did, but I don't have that anymore, and it was nothing.
Ate just nothing?
Like constantly hungry. I would never eat breakfast. I would eat after I worked out always. Like I'd eat on the bike, but I would never just always just drink a coffee and head out the door. I would never have anything beforehand.
Really?
Yeah. It was. I mean, I don't know if that's probably not good, but I felt like it kept me really, really skinny. So.
Damn, that's crazy. So like you got a 5 hour ride on.
Yeah, you'd start eating like whatever an hour or two in. You know, I'd start eating a bunch of food while I was riding, but I wouldn't eat anything before I'd go out.
That's crazy. So
for like 3 or 4 coffees.
Dude, that's unreal. I've never heard that. Yeah. That's crazy. Like I've heard. Here's another thing is, you know, you hear about all the ridiculous things like cycling to be at the very top of it is not healthy. In a way, and it's you do have to push it, and you do so many stupid things to try to get faster. And I always find it amazing just when you hear these stories of like pros of what guys have tried, whether it's right or wrong, whether it can be completely terrible for you and not beneficial, but just the insanity behind it. Like, so, you know, probably the most common one is you hear Tyler Hamilton talk about, you know, finishing a ride, drinking bubbly water and having some melatonin or sleeping pills just so he'd go to bed and trick his stomach into being full so he could fall asleep. Or Thomas Dekker talking about doing 280 kilometers of motor pacing when he was a junior. And like just like the most ridiculous things you hear guys did at the time. And I wonder, you not having breakfast, do you have any kind of ridiculous stories? Like what's the most ridiculous thing that you ever did to try to get faster?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that it really, I probably had a diagnosable eating disorder for parts, you know, like, I mean, it seems normal when you're in it, right? Because everyone's trying to stay skinny and do, you know, it's sort of a weird sport in that way. I mean, from my perspective, it was, you know, you'd go out and you'd do, I remember, I did this one ride, it was probably like 290K, and then I came home, and I mean, I ate tons while I was riding, right? Like, I mean, well, it was fair game while you're riding and just kind of eat what you want, but I came home and, you know, crushed a salad and then just kind of like lied on the couch and tried to ignore the hunger for, you know, for as long as possible. Just put on your computer. Back then we didn't have Netflix, so it was, you know, put on whatever you downloaded off the internet and just sort of drift away and then kind of do it again the next day. And you know, I mean, in hindsight, you know, looking at it, I definitely not the most healthy way of doing it at all. But sometimes, you know, and I'd say that maybe like probably under 50% of the time it worked, but it seemed like when it did work, it was really, really effective. So you get those little bits of positive reinforcement that kind of just instill those habits that with no pain comes no gain kind of deal.
For sure. And I mean, like the other thing is like when we talk about eating disorders and the sport is littered with them as far as like there's but the difference is the fact that, you know, guys are doing it for performance. It's not, you know, they're doing because they think it's going to make them faster. And once you realize, okay, I've pushed this too far and I just don't have any power.
Yeah.
Like I've figured out one half of the equation, the watts or the kilograms part, but now the watts are once you figure out that it's like it goes away and you start eating like it's not like, oh, you know, I'd really love to drop 5 pounds because these jeans would just look awesome or something. You know, it's different for us that way.
Totally.
But man, that's crazy. Like I can definitely empathize with that. And so what's the craziest thing that you ever heard though growing up? Like another thing is like I heard another, I love listening to podcasts and Todd Wells was on one and Todd Wells, mountain biker. And he talks about when like Yaroslav Kalhavy joined their team, how he was just doing so much more volume than everyone. And everyone saw that and was just taking it up. And suddenly everyone's going for rides after dinner and whatnot before bed and just training more and more and more. Was there ever anything like you witnessed or saw with another teammate or you heard someone else was doing it? You're like, oh, man, I got to do that.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. Like you hear like the whisperings of these things, but I think at the end of the day, like you just sort of figure out that like there's such a thing as junk miles, and like if there's no purpose to anything, that, and that's something that I feel like I started to learn maybe later on. And in terms of like actually do, like, no, because everyone that I kind of looked up to seemed to do it more systematically. Like you look at like the Rob Britton or like the Will Routley or those are the guys of my generation that were really successful. They were guys that were like quite specific with what they did, right? And so you kind of, you know, there's just sort of this weird mentality that more is better all the time. And I feel like I got sucked into that more so than anyone else. So in terms of like crazy stories of other people doing that, like surrounding me, not so much. I think that I was probably the biggest violator. You know, I'd be the guy who'd go out and I wanted to do 5 hours and everyone would be like, oh, we're at 4:48 and they'd be back at the hotel and be like, I'm going to get that other 12 minutes. And I'd go right around the block for 12 minutes, right? I mean, it was definitely like more, you know, anal about that kind of stuff, you know? So, which I think was probably more detrimental than it was actually, you know, helpful.
For sure. Like, I mean, in hindsight, you look back and you think like, oh, that was stupid. Like, why did I actually do the 12 minutes? Like, did that actually make me faster? But there's plenty of the good that comes away from it. And I have plenty of that stuff as well. And like, just some of the stupid things you do, like, oh, okay, I got to do a 30-minute effort, but this climb only lasts 25 minutes. So I'll just put a backpack on with rocks or something. Right. It's like, you know, just something stupid like that. And like, it's the most ridiculous stuff ever, but in the time it makes sense.
Then
the other thing I find that's really funny is just how in the zone you get when you're doing your training and your intervals. Like, this is the most important thing in the world. And red lights, mom with the baby stroller, anyone gets in my way, like, you better get out of my way.
Because
I'm training for it could be the tour or the provincial cup or anything like that. And this is the most important thing in the world. And I can break any law. And it's ridiculous. You act like such a jerk when you do your training and that you don't even realize it until you see someone else doing it. You're like, oh my God, that's me.
Totally. That's it. That's like, exactly. And you just become so narrow. Like your focus is so narrow and you're just in the zone, right? And like, that's kind of part of what makes you successful too, is that, you know, you're kind of unwavering in like what you're willing to sacrifice. You just want that quality. Like, you know, anything else is a waste of time. Like, I need the quality. You know, if I'm going to go out there and suffer, I mean, I want it to be done properly how it was prescribed. I don't want there to be any compromises, right? And like, that's just, I don't know. I think that's fairly normal, especially when you're in it's normal, but it's not normal.
Sure.
It's understandable, I suppose, is the better way to say it. But I definitely see similarity. That's how I was too, for sure. For sure.
And because the thing is, like, a lot of cyclists, you know, you're used to just having to like beg and plead and, you know, be such a polite, nice person. You're begging for dollars. Yeah. Everyone's fighting for contracts, trying to be so nice. And then it's like you get into, like, on the road in your train, you do such a jerk move like that. And when I, it's just, it's funny when you see it that way. It's like, man, the guy's actually probably a pretty nice guy. It's just, you know, all the blood's in his legs, not his head right now. But so what was, if you can look back on your cycling career, what was the high moment? What was the highest moment of your career?
Yeah, I mean, my last year riding was definitely my most like successful year, I would say. You know, I was finally able to like, you know, like compete at the level. Like I was in, on a continent, UCI continental team.
In Europe.
Yeah, in Europe. And we had a pretty good roster. We had a couple, like we had the like former US pro crit champion, former Australian crit champion, and we had the current UK crit champion. And so we had like a real good crit hit squad, and we won a ton of the crits in the UK, which are quite competitive. Like they're as competitive, if not more than competitive, than the ones in the States. We also, for myself, like I was finally able to like break through into that kind of like, you know, lower level UCI race. Like, and find myself in the mix and in the breakaway and like fighting for the win. You know, I, for me, like the highest, like the best result I ever had was I got second in a 1.2 in England. It's like a pretty, it was the only one day UCI race in the UK. And it was like, it was, I mean, what was it? I think it was like 2 degrees Celsius and I don't know how much precipitation fell. And it was like, they had to shorten the race in the middle of the race. And I don't even know how many finishers there were. I think there was like 170 starters and there was like 23 finishers or something. So for me, like a day like that, when like, you know, all of a sudden, instead of being kind of pack filler or carrying water bottles or like riding tempo in the front, I was like competing for the win, right? And you know, I didn't end up winning. I think I won the KOM or something, but you know, I ended up second in the mix, right? And for me, like as someone who was definitely a domestique for my entire, you know, like UCI level career, it was sweet to be, you know, to all of a sudden kind of have a little bit of a chance.
That's sweet. And so, you know, that's the high moment. But here's the thing about cycling is that's the high moment of your career. That's awesome. That's something you're never going to forget. And I completely understand why. But it's freezing cold. It's 2 degrees out. It's pouring rain. Yeah. And you're probably changing naked in a parking lot somewhere, jumping into a van.
Yeah, exactly.
Or have anti-doping tests or something like that going on after. And you're just like, man, like this is the dream right now.
Totally. It was the best. Yeah. There's so many moments that I remember from that thing. I remember like, can I swear on this thing? Go ahead, yeah. I remember like being in the breakaway was like 8 and we had our like best rider in the breakaway. And so I'm just on the front, just like sick. Like I like these odds. So I'm just going as hard as I can, like just not conserving anything. And like, I'm still sprinting for all the KOM things. Cause I'm like, oh, maybe I'll just get this as like a consolation. Cause I'm going to get dropped and I'm going to pull the chute. And hopefully there's only 4 guys left and our guy's fresh because I've made this move stick. So I go back to him. I'm like, all right, how you feeling? Like, what's going on? And he looks at me and he's like this Australian. He's like, cunt, what the fuck are you doing? Sit the fuck on. You're the strongest one here. He says to me. And like, that's something I'll never forget. Cause he's like just swinging there. And it's because the tables just completely turned when it was like, you know, 2 degrees Celsius and everything. Like all of a sudden, like it did, like the person who's from Calgary, Alberta, who like, you know, grew up like riding my bike in, you know, minus 15 with like my Sorels on flat thing. Like, you know, all of a sudden all these like soft people were like, Rain, ooh, what's this kind of deal? And that like finally was like the moment where I like, you know, and even though you're freezing in a parking lot afterwards, it's just, you know, you can take away so much, you know, satisfaction from that, you know, from that, those bits of suffering, really.
For sure. I mean, the language is something that's always so funny whenever, because cycling is such an international sport. Yeah. And like, when you hear about like trash talking about us, so like I grew up playing hockey and football and all the normal ball sports. And, you know, it's funny that way. Like people have time to actually think about like something funny to say to really get on it. In cycling, it's just like vicious, just cutthroat. And it's the same stuff over. But what's funny is when you hear it in all different languages.
Yeah.
And one thing I love listening to is European English is always so fun. Like you know, full gas the good form and all this.
Yeah.
Is there any like what's some of your favorite?
Hufredoma, like that one.
You What's know, that?
That's
I don't
like
know that
Flemish.
One.
I don't. I think it means like cunt, mother, or slut, or something. Like, I don't know what the direct translation is. It's just a really terrible thing. Yeah, Hufred or Krudva, I think, is another one. That's another.
Kurva.
Kurva, yeah.
That. Yeah, that's the Polish one. Yeah, I had Polish. Two Polish teammates this last year, and I swear they said that's the only word I just hear over and over and over again. And I asked them what it meant, and they just listed off like five or six different swear words, and I was like, oh, okay, all right. But I just hear that word over and over again. But you know what I find is really funny is how they use the term full gas, but they talk about full gas for anything. Like, you could be describing the cup of coffee you had this morning, the weather, the pace of the race, the bathroom stop. Like, oh, I went and took a piss and it was full gas. I need like full gas coffee, or the pace was full. They use it for describe everything. It's so funny that way. But then I think my least favorite term in Europe is when we go over to Europe, and you know, we're breaking all the rules, we're the foreigners, we don't know how anything works, and you're just trying to set up a whole new life, and it's really hard. And the phrase I kept hearing over and over again when you're on the phone and you're trying to figure out why your internet's not working, why they've shut down your phone plan and this, that, and other, and maybe the person speaks English, maybe they're, I kept hearing, this is not possible. This is not possible.
This is not possible.
And I'm thinking, like, why is this not possible? Like, this is why America is the land of opportunity, because in North America, this is possible. For some reason, this is not possible here, but in my country, this is possible.
Oh, that's funny.
And so, is it... What was the lowest moment in your career? And like, or you know what? Back up before then. How old were you when you made the jump over to Europe? Because that making the jump up to European, to be racing in Europe at the Conti level, that's really the last step before the big leagues, the World Tour, the biggest names in the world. Like, you can race on any continent, whether it's racing in North America, Asia, Europe. You know, Europe is the big leagues, and there you could be a Conti guy making $100 a week, or some guys are bringing their own sponsors, they're not paid at all, but you're in the biggest races racing against the guys that are making 6 million euros a year, driving all collecting Porsches and Rolexes, and you're doing some of the hardest races making nothing. And so it's really hard there. And so I'm wondering, how old were you when you made that jump across the pond to Europe?
So I was a bit older. I think I was 25 when I went over.
Okay.
So yeah, I guess like 10 years ago. So yeah, I was 25. I was a little bit different in that, like, I didn't really have any grand illusions of being in the World Tour or any, like, my goal was always, like, I think that, you know, you can't make a racehorse out of a donkey, and I knew what my limitations were. Like, I figured, like, if I could get on a continental team and I could get paid a little bit of money, and I could get travel around, go to the big races, maybe hang in there, carry a water bottle for a guy that can do half decent, you know, that was good enough for me, sort of deal. Race at the lower level, get on a podium every once in a while, impact the race. Like, that was, you know, that was my goal. And like, certainly that's what I hit. Right. So I was never, you know, I was never under any illusion that I was going to be like trying to win the Tour de France. That was never something, or, you know, or even participate. That was not, that's beyond, you know, what I'm genetically built to do. But I think that going over later, because by the time I went over, I'd finished my degree in university. Like, I just kind of was like, it was kind of like the fun tour, because, you know, I was taking it very seriously, and, you know, I was making tons of sacrifices, but at the same time, it was like, you know, when this is over, like, I don't have to like try to go back to school and wrap something up. I don't have to, you know, it's just kind of like, okay, I can kind of resume doing, you know, what I'd kind of meant as my plan. I don't want to call it plan B, because it's sort of, it's more like the plan A. It's I can resume kind of carrying on with life in general.
Chapter two.
Let's get perfect. That's the best way of putting it. Okay. I can do chapter two. So, you know, I only did 2 years continental over in Europe. And like, I was offered the contract I was offered for my third year with the team I was at was like way better than any of the contracts I'd had before. But I just couldn't, like, I guess this kind of sort of continues into like the low point. Is like, I was just like, I felt so isolated over there. Like, I'm a fairly social person. I've taught like a huge group of friends here. I have a huge group of friends in Victoria where I was living, and like, the thought of just like living in a house with a bunch of other foreigners that like all kept dropping like flies because they were burning out, and like living in some weird place away from all this for another year was like, nah, I was over it. So I tried to find something, you know, here, and when, you know, nothing of equal value or even close to equal value was available in North America, I was just like, nah, I'm done.
For sure. Well, that's great, man. That's cool that like you ended it on your own terms, but for sure the loneliness is always the biggest thing. Like, for me, I was living in a little village of maybe 500 people in Germany, nobody within 20 years of my age, no one speaks English, and you've gone 6 days, and the only thing you've said to someone is "Dunk a shame." To the woman at the grocery store, and you're just like, man, like, I am cracking. Like, I thought, when people talk about the loneliness one, I thought, like, you know what, I'd be okay with that. Like, you know, I have all my groups of friends here, and honestly, like, when I'm at home, I completely disassociate with road cyclists, because I'm just, yeah, I want to go hang out with my buddies that go skiing, dirt biking, kiteboarding, climbing, anything like that, because it's just so much more interesting for me. But, you know, I'm used to, you know, I always train on my own. I like training on my own. I like being off on my own, running in the mountains with just my dog or something. I'm like, you know what, I guess the loneliness should be fine for me. But man, when it's like you come home and you have no one to talk to, it's brutal. And so that was another thing, is like, that was the motivation for me this year, is like, for going back, it's like, okay, like, when you're living in North America, you're kind of just living such, you realize what a gravy train it is. Because, mm-hmm, I mean, getting up to just go ride your bike and train all day, that's great. And what are the sacrifices you're really making? Like, okay, school will be there after. Hanging out with your friends, like missing a couple parties, whatever. You're getting to chase your dream. That's awesome. Like, those are really small sacrifices. When you go over to Europe and you have to go leave your whole life behind, you don't have friends, anything there, you have to go build it, that's a real sacrifice. And that's where I was just like, okay, if I'm coming back here, like, that's the motivation in the back of my head. It's like, I'm not going to be suffering like this the whole time. I'm working towards the very top and doing every last little thing, or I'm not doing this.
So for me, I got like really addicted to online shopping when I was there, and it was mostly so.
You must have been paid pretty well. I wish I could have got that addiction.
Yeah. And so I was like,
what are you buying?
Just like different kinds of oatmeal, all sorts of stuff. No, clothes.
How did you pay to ship them all home?
It was, yeah. Well, I had to send some suitcases separately, but. The thing is, I was like so addicted to it, and then the postman would come drop it off, and he'd be there, and I'd just be like, hey, like,
you were the crazy old man.
I was like trying to talk to him, you know, like, because we became familiar with one another, and I'd be like, okay, the guy's got to come drop me a package off today. I'm gonna like see how his day, and like, he didn't. You know, it was sort of like that. I could tell it, you know, the nonverbal. He's like, yeah, I don't want to talk to you. Yeah, you know, I can't really understand what you're saying because you're speaking too fast and weird North American slang. But for me, I didn't care. It was my human encounter for the day. So,
were you based in the same place all?
It was like the Midlands of England. The bikes, like, now the team's, I forget what it's called now, Vitus, I think, or something. It's another continental team. But actually, they had some, this year they had quite a strong team. They had a couple like Olympic gold medalists on their team from the track. It's like a totally different team. But it was sponsored by Rally Bikes, which is, you know, it's like quite a big name that has some pedigree. You know, like the Rally Thai won the Tour de France in like 79 or 78 or something. So it was like trying to be like a reincarnation to reestablish the bike brand as like, you know, higher end. And their factory's in Nottingham, which is like right in the center of England. So we lived in a town just outside of where Nottingham was.
Okay.
Which is kind of where like the main sponsor was.
Okay, but at least in England, at least the language barrier wasn't there.
Yeah, no language barrier. I mean, and the road riding, to be fair, was very, very, very good. You know, the lane, like, other than the weather being, you know, hit or miss, they have just so many like lanes which are paved old cartways that they don't have like any method or madness. There's no grid or anything. They just are sort of old roads that have all been paved over, and so you can go ride on these tiny little bike path things for like hundreds and hundreds of kilometers and never do the same ride twice. You can always it's crazy. And there's tons of, you know, I'd say like the bigger hills are maybe 400 meters in elevation gain, but okay, you know, that's still, and it's not like you're in the mountains, but there's just tons of the like hills that big, which is, you know, creates a
proper climb.
Yeah.
Sweet.
So okay. Super good road riding, you know, and like no language barrier, and English like pub culture is really cool too. Like cottage food. So there's like, culturally, it was a pretty easy place to live.
That's nice. And so you were always living with other people?
Yeah. But it's funny because I was always living with foreigners. Like, and by foreigners, I mean we were the foreigners. So first year, I lived with two Americans and a Dutchman.
Okay.
And by like July, I think I was the only person left in the house. You know, they'd all, the Americans had fucked off or gone and done something else. And the Dutch guy was like, I don't know, he was there for a bit, and then he would go back to Holland for a while, because, yeah, if my house was an hour and a half away, I'd go home too, right?
Sure.
If you were going to do a period where you weren't going to race for a little while, I'd go home. But
yeah,
I didn't have that luxury, so, you know, I'd just be stuck there kind of hanging out with the postman.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like, that's the one thing I thought about, is the fact, like, man, this would be so much easier if I just had, like, another North American here with me. That way, when I feel like a toddler at the grocery store because I can't read the food labels,
yeah,
or I'm someone else to feel like a toddler with and just like laugh at the things that you're getting in trouble for or whatnot, or you know, just go back to the land of burritos and the air conditioning is not going to give you the black plague. Yeah. And you just like someone else, like when you're just like pulling your hair out, like you guys are insane. Yeah. Like the AC is not going to kill us.
And it's 40 degrees outside. Like yeah. I'm sweating through, you know, like.
Oh man, I can't believe it. Like, but the nicknames I had on my team this year were Grizzly. That's the most common one. Tarzan. And the other thing is there was a Dutch guy on our team. Yeah, great guy. Really, really great guy. But he kept calling me the Forester. And I couldn't understand, like, what's that? Man, that doesn't make sense. Like, he speaks great. I figured it out by the end. It was literally me driving back into Squamish at the end of the season and seeing the statue of the big lumberjack. And I'm like, a lumberjack. He meant a lumberjack, not the Forester. He's been calling me the Forester all year. It's a lumberjack. Okay. But they think when I talk about like cross country skiing, dirt biking, climbing, they look at me like I'm a space alien.
Oh yeah,
when you do this, like it's so funny.
It doesn't exist. and like yeah, cycling. I feel it's funny because cycling is such like a, especially road cycling, I should say, is like a, such an outdoor kind of like you're in the element sort of sport. But from my experience, most cyclists are like real city people, you know, like tight jeans, white stitched jeans and like flashy shoes and like Gucci glasses. Like no one's really an outdoors person, you know, although like the bulk of their time is spent and like they're incredibly tough, you know.
Yeah,
like they can endure a lot, but it's sort of like on the flip side, they're not, you know, they're not like earthy people at all.
Well, that's the thing, the part that I didn't understand is like you guys will finish a race in 3 degrees and pouring rain and be shivering and jackhammering by the end, and like that's a race, or you'll finish a training ride like that, but the air conditioning is gonna make us sick, or you know, not getting or getting on a plane without this big scarf on and whatnot is gonna make us sick. And I was just anyways, I couldn't believe some of this stuff. But so now you live a life where I'm not going to get into probably the obvious things of what you don't miss about cycling is the fact that when it's horrible out, when it's snowing out and it's horrible for cycling out, you don't have to get on the trainer right now to do the train. You can say, I'm going to go skiing today. I'm looking forward to those days. I'm wondering, like for after my cycling career, I'm wondering, is there anything you miss about life right now that you had in cycling that you don't have right now? Is there anything you miss about the cycling life?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. There's like, it's like free, it's freeing. I really like, what I really liked was the lifestyle a ton. I mean, you're like what I have in freedom now, I didn't have in free, like it's sort of like a switch. So you know, when you're a professional cyclist, you know, you have like your day-to-day, you can just do your own schedule, do what you want, as long as you ride in, you know, it's so free, right? You have, you know, time is whatever you make of it kind of thing. Whereas now, you know, I have a job and I have more responsibility. And so I have, you know, the bulk of my day is accounted for and it's budgeted for. But on the flip side, you know, when you go to race, like maybe more on the macro level, like I can plan what I'm doing in a weekend in August now. I can say, yeah, I'm free that weekend and I can do that. Whereas cycling, like, you can't do that because you don't know if you're going to get tossed into a race. And that sort of, that lack of flexibility is something I don't miss, but at the same time, from day to day, you know, like get up, have a coffee, sleep until whatever, you know, that sort of freedom is something that, you know, is very nice.
Okay. And then I guess, so what are all the hobbies and stuff that you do right now?
Yeah. So I get like cycling was like the best thing that cycling ever gave me is like, it gives you just like an awesome aerobic engine and you can use that thing for so many things. And especially, you know, in a place like Squamish or like trail running or backcountry skiing and thing, like all of a sudden, because I had this background in endurance sport, I mean, going for like a crazy long run is not out of the, like, you just have the ability to do it, right? And mm-hmm. off the couch it a little bit, right? So, you know, what I enjoy doing now is like Squamish is, like, I don't know, for anyone that's never looked at what Squamish is, it's like the Mecca of outdoors. And so trail running is huge. I do a lot of that and it's way more time effective as well for, you know, if you've got a job or whatever, but backcountry skiing is probably my favorite. And you know, I've like loved getting into that. you know, I like the touring aspect, the like aerobic aspect of like, you know, trying to ski something that's, you know, a little bit fun, managing the risk, all that stuff. But I don't know, there's so much camping, fast packing. Like, you know, the year after I quit cycling is like when I really kind of started getting after it. Like I ran Like we have the West Coast Trail in Canada, so I went and just ran that. I ran the one to Fuca Trail, ran the North Coast Trail, like all the stuff on the island.
You've done all those ones?
Yeah, yeah, in a day. Yeah, I did it all in like within like a 3 month period or something.
How long did it take you to do the West Coast Trail? A day?
Like 13 hours.
How long is that? That's like 75K, isn't
no,
it?
No, it's a bit more. I think the route that I took was about 83, but the thing that made it even longer is that Banfield's probably about 6K from the end. And so I ran it from the south to the north. So doing that, we had to get up at like 4 a.m. and then there's a river, like the trail starts on the other side of the river. So most people, what's included in your fee when you sign up for it is you wait till 9 a.m. and then this dude shuttles you across the river in a boat. But for us, we had to swim across. So we had to do the swim across the river.
With your gear?
Yeah, with your gear.
And how?
It's actually funny how it worked is like you got this giant Ziploc bag. I don't know how, like maybe it was like 2 feet by 1.5 feet. And you put your little hydro pack in it. And I kept my shoes on because there was barnacles on the rocks because it was sort of like a brackish river. And you like blew up the Ziploc bag and then sealed it. And so it was like a flotation as well. And then just like backstroked across this river. And then you get across the river and you feel like you've already accomplished the day, which you haven't.
And this is still like, what, 4 a.m?
Yeah, 4:30, like some crack of dawn. And I did it on the solstice. So we had as much daylight as possible. And then, then you head north. And like the real crux is that there's a ferry crossing in the middle. So if you don't, and it's time, like it starts going at like 10 a.m. till 5 p.m. But they're very strict. At 5 p.m. they're like, nah, we're not shuttling anyone across. And if you don't make it, you can't swim that one. There's way too much current in it. So I was fine, made it there, and then just cruised. It was a super enjoyable day. It was an awesome day. And then, but you get to the end, and it's like 6K from the end of the trailhead into the town where we'd booked our Airbnb. And I didn't realize it was 6K. So you like finish this long 13-hour run, and then I'm like, fuck, like, I guess I still gotta walk like 6K to this goddamn town. So I'm like walking down the street. Every car that comes by, I got my thumb out. No one picked me up. So I just hobbled into town.
Of course, because you look disgusting. You've been running for 13 hours through the jungle.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Rambo.
Exactly. So yeah, but I ended up like went there and then found this Airbnb. And the woman that was hosting it thought that we were going to be there a bit earlier because I thought
she didn't want to let you in the house either.
Well,
like
she was
a stray
awesome.
Cat.
She called the pub, which was just down the street, like down a hill.
Not the doctor.
Called the pub. And she got them to keep it open for me. So I went down there.
At what time? The pub was closed already.
No. Because like 13 hours started at 4. Like, you know, it's only like 5 or 6 at night, right? So they were shutting it down. Like, I don't know. I was like, I think we did it at all.
Oh, so this is just like a normal restaurant. This isn't a bar.
No, like, well, it's a pub in Banfield, so yeah, restaurant-y bar, like, you know, just like, I don't know how many people live there.
More than a taco truck.
Yeah, more than a taco truck. So I just jammed like 3 or 4 pints. I don't even think it didn't even do anything, right? It just sort of, your body is like, it's not putting any of that boost to the fun account. It's all going to the we need this for repairing your body account. Hobbled back, and it was pretty funny. I did it with like 6 of us started it together, but we had this like disclaimer email chain that was like, if you can't hack it, like, we're leaving you, like, because I'm not staying out here with you. So it ended up, we all started together, and after about 4 hours, everyone was just kind of by themselves. And then we all just sort of ended up at this place at different, I was the first one there, and then like, I don't know, 4 or 5
Wait,
hours.
So, sorry, how many people started?
Six of us.
Six, you got 6 people, you convinced 6 people to go do this run.
So 5, so 6 including myself, yeah. It's pretty common. Like a lot of people do it now. Like, and that was 2013. So that was, what, 7 years ago or something. So it was a little less. Like people had definitely done it then, but it wasn't like, I think now they have a lot of runners doing it. Mm-hmm. So it was a little more, you know, a little more of like a barrier, I guess, to doing it. Like,
that's awesome. Because my idea is like, this is something the reason I'm so curious about this is something I want to do. Because my idea was to leave my truck in between the Juan de Fuca Trail and the West Coast Trail, run the Juan de Fuca one day, camp in my truck, run the West Coast Trail the next day.
Yeah.
But this is awesome to hear that you'd already done it.
Yeah, so Gary Robbins, I don't know if you know who that is, but he's done, he's got the FKT under 24 hours for doing them consecutively. And he ran the in between them too, which is insane.
That is ridiculous. See, that's what I love about this place. Is like, that's just another day here. That's a weekend trip. Anywhere else in the world, this is like a lifelong goal to go run 87 kilometers.
I think it was 83 is how long the trail was, and then however long the
This is not on a road or a track. This is through the mountains, the jungle, like rough West Coast.
Yeah, it's definitely like the West Coast Trail is. By comparison, the Juan de Fuca Trail, I think, is probably like a more difficult trail.
It's a gnarlier one.
It's like 48K versus 83.
Mm-hmm.
But there's sections of the West Coast Trail. I don't know how many ladders there, but there's a ton of ladders on it. like over 100 ladders on it. So it's kind of, you know, you're not making good time on ladders, but it's pretty stimulating. West Coast Trail is just, you know, you're, it's funny because it's such a, it's like a super popular, like it's iconic.
It's a bucket list trip. It's,
yeah.
If you Google top, maybe it wouldn't show up on every top 10, but if you Google top 50 hikes in the world, without a doubt, West Coast Trail and Juan de Fuca. Maybe not Juan de Fuca because it's not known as well, but West Coast Trail for sure is showing up top 50 hikes in the world.
Yeah, I would say most likely. But the best part is like when you're cruising out there and you have a 5-liter backpack on and you're like 45K into this thing and you're passing people with like
dirt. 70 pounds of gear, scented yeah, candles
like,
and whatnot.
They look at you like, where did this person come from?
It's so funny. The thing I love is when you're out on, and like this happens anywhere you go. Like I remember I was snowshoeing like a week ago or so. And I'd been out for, you know, a while. I'd been out for the day, and you're just coming down the trailhead by the end of it. And I know, like, the last hairpin where it is, and I know from there it's, like, 20 minutes. And there's the classic family coming up, and, you know, good on them for their, you could tell, like, there's the younger daughter who was maybe in around, like, 22 or so. She's up ahead dropping mom and dad behind, and you could tell this was just like, okay, we're gonna go and do a fun hike together today and whatnot. Oh yeah, they Google this one looks good in Squamish, and then they're out and you can already tell they're 20 minutes into this hike. Maybe they were I think it's about 20 minutes back. They were kind of looking like they were about an hour or seven into this hike, and the daughter's like already dropping them and just like already getting frustrated, and then the dad looks over at me and is like, there's like a cabin up here, right? And I'm looking like, oh man, they're thinking about Elfin Lakes. And that's like a good 13K from here. And you're like 450 meters into this.
It's like on the chief here, like at the top of the stairs. I've seen like high heels or you see that. And people, they're like, how much further? And like the stairs is probably like 1/30th. Of the way to the top, but I always make a habit of being like, oh, you're almost there. Like, it's just, oh, you know.
Yeah. I tell that too. It's like, oh, yeah, right there.
Yeah, you're yeah, totally. There. Yeah, you're no stress. There. It's just almost there.
Oh, it's brutal. But you know what's funny about the Chief is that the one that cracks me the most is when you get the tour buses go there, and it'll be like July. And so it way up in the Alpine, there is snow still in the mountains there left over from the, but you have people that come off the tour buses to go hike the Chief, and they're getting off with snow gaiters and ice axes. And I'm looking, and I'm like, we're standing on the highway right now. You can see the top. There's no snow there. Where are you going with your big knee-high snow gaiters and ice axes? And, but then skinny jeans as well. Yeah. And it's like, oh, wow, you just went to Mountain Equipment Co-op and bought all the gear.
Oh, yeah, get the gear.
Oh, it's pretty funny. And then, you know, going more on the Chief there, I have some buddies that work for Search and Rescue. And I was like, man, like, you guys must have, like, some really cool stories and whatnot. Like, I'd love to do Search and Rescue, but blood kind of freaks me out enough. Like, I wouldn't want to see a broken leg or something like that or someone dead. I wouldn't want to be... scraping up the dead body or out of a valley somewhere. I couldn't do that. But I asked them like if they had any kind of crazy stories and stuff. And they're like, man, you know what? We wish we did, but the most common story we get is these dipshits come up from the city to go hike the Chief to watch the sunset and then don't bring a flashlight to get back down. So we have to go up, walk up the Chief at 10 o'clock at night just to walk these guys down. And we can always find them because they got their iPhones out. They're just trying to get down the trail with the flashlight on the iPhone.
That or just surprise me.
Oh, so good. But okay, so let's... if you do all these crazy sports, if money's no object, you can go anywhere in the world, where would you love to go on a trip?
I mean, like, yeah.
To do anything. Doesn't have biking, skiing, hiking, camping, race speedboats, whatever you want.
I mean, it's such a funny question because for me, I mean, I really am not bit by the travel bug at all. I mean, I already did that kind of thing. So it would be all over BC. There's so much to explore in the backyard. Like, I'd want to go to Bella Coola and I'd want to ski probably. Or I'd want to just do like a 3 or 4 week road trip through like through BC, just ski touring. That would be the best. That's what I would want to do the most for sure. Like BC is just my favorite. I feel like so at home in BC and yeah, I wouldn't want to leave.
Sweet. So just like loading up a truck, putting gear in.
Loading up a truck and putting gear in, you know, staying in a combination between in the truck and, you know, and camping and then maybe in like the odd hotel or whatever. But like, you know, really, really getting after it in BC, like northern BC all the way up like to Waddington kind of. But also, you know, like all the way even going north all the way up to Yukon kind of thing. And even into like, you know, I haven't really explored the Selkirks very much. Like I'm pretty new to, you know, like since quitting cycling and getting into sort of, mountain culture a little bit more. You know, I'm still like super, super new at it. And there's so much, like barely scratched the surface of my own backyard. And that's where I get the most enjoyment is kind of, you know, exploring stuff around here. And, you know, I don't really want to go to like Southeast Asia or, yeah, anywhere else yet. So much. Yeah, you know, yet. There's still appeal to do it. But if I have a 4-week chunk and it's up to me, like that's what I would do is I would hang out here and just explore things around here, like some of the classic stuff around here for sure. Sweet. That I haven't done.
And like, does the avalanche factor ever scare you? Like, yeah. So did you get into backcountry skiing after cycling?
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, for sure it does. I mean, you know, you can only learn so much, you know, and at the end of the day, it's give me a chance. But yeah, I'm pretty like risk adverse, I would say. I'm definitely a bit of a scaredy cat. That being said, like I've put myself in, you know, places where things, you know, can slide, you know, for mm-hmm. sure. And I go out there, but I take, you know, I've taken AST1 and AST2, have a bunch of days in the backcountry. I always ski with an airbag if I'm going into like bigger terrain.
So explain what an airbag is for anyone that doesn't know what that is.
You know, so an airbag is just like, so it's a backpack that has, the one I have is, it's got like a lithium battery and it's got an electronic fan and it inflates a balloon that just basically increases your volume. And the theory is that larger particles when moving rise to the top. So by making yourself larger in an avalanche, you're more likely to stay on top of the debris than you are to sink beneath it.
And this airbag is huge. Like it pops out of the backpack. And
yeah. So the backpack just looks like a normal backpack, right? But then you pull the little lever thing, the handle, and then
G.I. Joe.
Yeah, exactly. It just, and then it looks super funny. It looks like you have a giant balloon kind of like surrounding your head, like a big inflatable orange piece. And so, yeah, it's not like, you know, there's a lot of evidence that should suggest that when people get these or when these safety mechanisms. So for example, like when transceivers and probes and shovels became the norm in backcountry skiing, you know, most people thought that the amount of avalanche fatalities would decrease, but they increased because everybody had this false sense of confidence with mm-hmm. this. So there's sort of, you need to think about that too. Like this thing is by no means making you any more impervious to like the consequences of an avalanche. It's just, you know, it's a stats thing. It's statistically by wearing one of them and using it, if you ever, you're more likely to end up on top of the debris than you are beneath it. So it's just a precaution to take that I definitely, that's not as nice to ski with it because it's a little bit heavier, but you know, like little things like that are within my control, you know, do that kind of thing. But for the most part, it's just not being a cowboy and kind of you know, I'm just staying within my limits and comfort zone.
You just have friends that taught you stuff?
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I sort of slowly started getting dragged out by friends that, and then, you know, once you kind of establish your ski touring core, ski touring is sort of a weird sport because it's like, it's very exclusive. You know, once you kind of have your four or five people that you ski with, you don't really like to ski with other people so much, I find, unless you're doing a mellow day. Just because
like, is the risk part?
Yeah, because you're trusting yourself and you know like the group dynamics and things. And like when you kind of get like an outlier in the mix, you don't really know how it's going to play out. And you know, if you're going to go do something bigger,
because you're thinking, if I get buried, do I trust this guy to find me?
That, but then also like group dynamics can get funny too, in that, you know, when you're making a big decision or you're communicating with one another, if you have somebody that's really gung-ho to ski something and somebody who's, you know, has concerns, how you manage that is very mm-hmm. important. And so by having, you know, having a group that you're comfortable, you know, saying, hey, you know, I'm not comfortable with this anymore. I'm not going to do this. And you're not scared of offending anyone or scared of, you know, having to deal with consequences of somebody who's so ambitious and so dead set on doing something, right? Like, and so how that's managed, that's a huge part of it. And, you know, you sort of figure that out with your good friends and with people that, and then you learn how to trust them and their decision making and listening to their rationale for doing things. And so that sort of that working of the group dynamics is incredibly important. And so it can kind of be challenging when, you know, someone finds out that you ski tour and they say, oh, we should go out sometime. And they really desperately want to come along with you. Like it's, you know, it's not like you don't want to hang out with them. It's more that if you say no or whatever, it's not like, it's just sort of, you know, it's there's almost like you need to start a baby steps when you start putting new people into the group kind of deal. You need to, let's go like ski a little thing here, maybe ski at Whistler, do some slack country. And then you kind of, you know, you work your way into seeing how it will fit. It's not like you kind of, which is unlike, you know, a hike is completely different or a mm-hmm. bike ride is completely different. So it's a little counterintuitive. So yeah, I found that kind of a weird bit about ski touring that I've kind of learned. And I think that's really important in terms of feeling comfortable in avalanche terrain.
Huh, that's super interesting, because that's like, for sure, the thing I hated about cycling is, like, when I got into road cycling, what I hated was just how, like, snobby it was. How, like, yeah. I was like the 14, 15 year old kid with plastic bags on my shoes trying to, like, go and figure out this ridiculously expensive sport, and there's like 40 year old men on the weekends just, like, giving me a hard time because, you know, your gear's not as nice as someone else's. And I hated that. And that's like, that was my opinion when I first got in, and that's why I just started training by myself. And I always train by myself, and but that's what I love about, like, the mountain sports activities, is I feel like everything is so welcoming. Everyone is just stoked to finish and do it all. But that's really interesting to hear, like, and I completely understand it.
And but that's not, it doesn't necessarily need to be mean about it. It's just like, you know, most people understand that.
No,
but
it's totally justified.
But there is also, I mean, to the, like, I get the elite sport, like the elite, this elitism sort of road cycling. And it is, like, it can be obnoxious for sure. It is bad for that. And not everyone is bad, but I'd say on whole, I mean, you pointed it out, I definitely felt the exact same way. Mm-hmm. But there's sort of, like, with skiing and especially, there's scarcity, you know, it's powder and there's a good zone and you know, there's only so much of it until it gets skied out, and you know, you don't want people there. So there's this kind of weird bro culture sort of territorial element to it as well that I guess there isn't in road biking, right? Like, the road's still going to be there if you go ride it or if I go ride it. There isn't that same element. So that's something that cycling, I think, has that skiing lacks.
Okay, cool. And then, so we're talking about like avalanche gear and whatnot. And this is, like, I find this stuff so cool. Like, the amount of, like, just gear you can get is so cool. Like, for Christmas, my parents, when I was a little kid, would literally buy me the Mountain Equipment Co-op catalog. Like, the catalog was the present. Cause, like, I'd be like 8 years old and wanting, like, a mummy sleeping bag and ice axes and whatnot. And going to school wearing five jackets because I was pretending in kindergarten because I was pretending I was going mountain climbing and stuff. And the teachers are all wondering, is like, is he sick or something? It's like, no, he thinks he's going mountain climbing. But it's like, the gear is so cool. And so we talked about the avalanche bag, and then, like, the Avalung is, like, another crazy thing. Like, it's this tube that is on your backpack again, and it's up by your mouth, and then the exhaust, so you can breathe into it, and the exhaust is down by your butt. And so it's, if you were to get buried in an avalanche, it's, and you're completely buried, basically, like, you run out of air really quick. And so what they tell you in my very limited avalanche training is, they tell you, if you're getting buried, to bring your hands up around your head to protect your head and your neck and whatnot, but also to keep them moving, to try to give yourself a big air pocket around your head to give yourself more breathing room once all the snow sets and you stop moving. And then the whole thing with the Avalung is the fact that what happens if you don't have that is your warm breath melts the snow all around you and creates, like, an ice bubble, and then you run out of air really quick that way. So the Avalung is supposed to buy you, like, another 30 minutes or so for people to find you. And so, like, it's just so crazy, all the cool gear and stuff you can get into there. And I'm wondering, is there any, like, what's your go-to gear out of all the sports and stuff you have? Like, is there any items, and, you know, not sponsor anything here, but, like, is there any, like, that thing is amazing? Like, that, any specific pieces of gear that, like, you, yeah, just, well, something that stands out?
I can tell you, like, my two most used pieces of gear that I have, and that's the Arc'teryx Norvan SL jacket, which is one of the non-face fabric Gore-Tex pieces. And I know, I think Seven Meshes, it's called the Oro. And it's it's the same one. And so I use that a ton because you don't even have to think about it. You can just put it in your pocket and bring it because it's so light. But it is a waterproof, breathable, true and true. Like, it is crazy how well that stuff works. So yeah, I use that thing for everything. Maybe not ski touring, but I use it for biking, especially here in the coastal climate, that. And the other thing that's really cool is called the Naked Belt. And it's like, it's like this little thing in it. I mean,
Fanny pack.
Yeah, it's like a little fanny pack, but it's crazy how much.
But it's cool because it's for ultra running. So it's not fanny pack.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, it holds so much stuff.
Doesn't hold coupons.
I did, so I went through this phase, actually, listening, like, maybe another sidebar, but where I was, like, really, like, obsessed with trying to do things like people's weekends after work. And so, like, I went and ran the House Sound Crest Trail, like, after work one day, or, like, like, went and did the Black Tusk after work one day, or things like
that's what I love about this place. I went
and skied off, like, JD, my buddy JD.
Like, these are weekend trips for anybody who doesn't know. And Jamie's like, yep, off at 5. Yeah. I'll be back by 2 in the morning.
No, not even. Like, you're like, those ones are so, like, I think house on Crest Trail. I was home at like 10:30 at night, or like, and you know, and I'm leaving at 4:30.
Running across the ridge of yeah. how many mountains?
It's crazy what you can do after work. And that I credit so much of that to cycling, because it gives you that that aerobic engine. Or like what, like my buddy Janie and I, we like literally, it was June, like mid June on a like large snow year, and we skied off the summit of Trikuni on a Tuesday night after working full days at like 6:30 p.m. You know, and it was just like, where else can you do that? Or like, how can you do that? But yeah, sure. That was like a little bit of a side thing. I mean, the kind of, I don't know, that's, it's just using your time super well. But the naked belt, I went around the house on Crest Trail. It was awesome. Like, yeah, I just wore a belt, and you know, you have like, I had a Gore-Tex shell in there, had a soft flask, and I had some, whatever, some goose or I don't know, something in there. And yeah, that's it. Like, you can totally, it was totally fine. You have your phone in there and just go for it. You don't have to bring one of those like ultra runner vests or something. Just have your freaking bat belt with all your stuff in there. It's sweet.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
And then so like, as a cyclist, so you say you don't like, travel bug doesn't get you as much right now, but like as a cyclist, you travel a lot and you live out of a suitcase a lot. Everyone's kind of got like their unique things that they bring with them and whatnot. So for a lot of cyclists, like the AeroPress is probably the most common one, because cyclists are coffee nerds, and like, I'm not really into that. Like, I don't bring an AeroPress with me all the time. Did you ever have anything that like you had to travel with?
Coffee. So yeah, the 100% coffee. Like I am 100. I'm so dependent on coffee. I got really into coffee. I still am super into coffee. I can tell you all about the coffee, everything about all the coffee that I drink and how I make it. But I remember one time that I decided that I was not going to bring my coffee set up with me. I'm like, they'll have coffee there, it'll be fine. And I went down and did the tour of Tobago. And I was like, you know, whatever, I'm not going to bring it, it's going to take up too much space. And I went down there and it was instant coffee for 2 weeks straight. I couldn't find, and there's no beans, nothing. And it's like, it was the worst. And so as of that trip, I always brought my, you know, I brought my hand grinder, a bag of beans, and you know, either an AeroPress or I just bring like the V60, the pour over setup.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And yeah, that was it. Like, as long as I had a way to make coffee, it was good.
Okay.
That came with me everywhere.
Okay, because I did it for a while. Like, because I really like coffee. I'm not as much of a nerd as you. Like, you know, I want fresh beans, good cup of coffee. I always drink black cup of coffee and good cup of coffee. But the thing is, like, I'm okay. Like, it's not worth the effort to me to bring all that, because I started thinking, like, man, this is a lot of stuff to fit in my suitcase and whatnot, and hand grinding it in the hotel room. When I was like, I'm sure I can find good coffee there and whatnot. And when you can't, it's like, I'll just stomach the bad coffee, or I won't have coffee. I'll just like not have a cup of coffee once in a while. So that was my thing there. But I'm trying to think of, you know, a unique thing that I'm going to start traveling with next year, is like, after doing the Euro thing and you constantly worried about, like, so I like getting up early in the morning. Like, I'm always up at like 5 in the morning, 4, 5, 6 in the morning. And I just like, you know, reading or writing and stuff like that in the morning. And if I'm going to be arguing with, if the air conditioning's not allowed on, the window's not allowed to be on, and I don't want to be waking anyone up at that time or anything, I'm going to start bringing like scented candles, I think, of just like that smell like the outdoors, whether it's going to be like cedar or something like that. Cause it's like a little tin. It's like, oh, the size of like a chewing tobacco thing. I think it's a good idea.
There's some, actually, I should give you the one. We have one. It's spruce pine right now that Lauren keeps.
There you go.
And it's, like, it reminds me, yeah, that's a great idea.
I think that's why, because, you know, if I got to bring something that sounds like home, because I thought maple syrup would do it for me.
Yeah.
The thing is, in Europe, maple syrup is so expensive there. It's like, it's more expensive than oil. That's why there I'm like, well, I can't do this. I can't get my maple syrup, I guess. And, you know, I'd go through a lot of that. So I figured, you know what? Scented candle. Smells like my backyard.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know what? Make fun of me if I'm going to be the girly guy with scented candles and whatnot. Yeah. But you know what? I want our hotel room to not smell like wet cycling shoes
in the day. Well, and scent, like, especially with, like, if you're lonely or homesick or whatever, like, scent's such a good, you know, it gets the memories going a bit, or it gets it's nostalgic. It's good.
I think that's a great idea.
I don't know if I'd give up my coffee for it. Because it's kind of like my medicine.
for sure. And, you know, I've learned way too much about coffee from some of my teammates and whatnot. Not way too much. I really like it. I really like my coffee, but I'm just not as dedicated to preparing it as much as some guys. Like, there's a machine and everything there. I'll get on it, start running it, but I'm not going to carry it with me. But, okay, how about e-bikes? Have you tried an e-bike yet?
I mean, I've cruised around blocking one, but that's it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, so we'll leave that one there.
Yeah, no, the jury's out. Every bone of me wants to hate them, but I the logical part of me is like, they're kind of good for a lot of applications. So just kind of an ego hit when you're out there cruising along and you're like just smashing it on your XC bike, and then some dude just like, hey, on your left, you're like, no, but I worked so hard to be able to go this fast and now I can't. And this guy's just cruising by because he bought an e-bike. But I mean, whatever. It's humbling, I guess.
I mean, dude, so that's the opinion I had at first one. And I think you got to try it, because the thing is, like, when I first saw him, I was like, man, you know what? That sucks. Earn your turns. Then my next opinion was, well, you know what? If it's going to get people on bikes that weren't on bikes before, that's awesome. Yeah. Get them out, because they still have to exercise a little bit.
Oh, for sure.
To do it. And then I actually got on one, and you're just like, this is the most fun toy I've ever had. Ever.
Yeah.
Because it's, you can still work just as hard. Like, you can get your heart rate up just as high, like ripping up the climbs, but you just go twice as fast. Sweet. And it's like almost like the endorphin you get from biking and then like ripping on your dirt bike as well. It's Sweet. It's ridiculous. It's so much fun. And you just, the thing is, I also think the fitter you are, the better they are. So like, if you're out of shape and you're not into biking at all, and you're like, oh, well, I can get an e-bike and now I can be a mountain biker, it's like, it's going to be okay for you. It's like, okay, now you can just do it. But if you're someone who already bikes all the time and this is your third bike or something like that, and you're fit enough to like really lay on it, oh, dude, Sweet. It's like merging two different sports between motorcycles and bicycles.
I'll have to try that out.
Yeah. But okay, so out of all the epic stories and stuff, or out of all the hobbies and stuff you do, is there an epic story that comes out? So we talked about, you know, the West Coast Trail, the Juan de Fuca Trail. Those are crazy days. And the thing is, you're glazing over, like running the House Sound Crest Trail after work. Like, that's gnarly, dude. That is a day-long trip for an elite athlete. But like, so what's your go-to party story? Your wow story, like, this was the day I will remember. Or week.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, for the hardest day, like, I know the hardest day I ever did, and I don't know if it was necessarily like the one I'll remember the most. Like, I mean, the one I'll remember the most probably is the Stein Valley this year, because I bear maced myself in the face like 8 kilometers into the 100K fast pack.
I remember I saw a photo of this. You putting your head in a puddle, just looking like death.
Yeah, definitely. I won't live that one down. We went to go do the Stein Valley, which is like unreal. It was last year.
Which is around here.
Yeah. So it's actually, Stein Valley, like what it is it runs from Lillooet Lake, Pemberton area to Lytton. So it crosses that divide there. Mm-hmm. But it's the only unlogged watershed in all of southwestern BC. So, and it was protected. It's actually really cool. If you look it up, there's a bunch of old CBC like bits done that are on YouTube from the early 90s of like hippie jam bands and stuff, like trying to protect it, because it has, not only is it like ecologically significant, but it's also, there's so much cultural significance to it as well, because it's an old like Aboriginal like hunting routes and trade routes, and there's a lot of petroglyphs and things in there, so there's like a lot of cultural significance in this thing, which is really cool with what it is. But it's sweet because you start off by going up an old logging road branch that has been deactivated because of a huge landslide, took the road out, and it hasn't been good to go since like 2003 or 2002 or something. And then you get up sort of this beautiful lake called Lizzie Lake. And then from there on in, you're like in the Alpine for the next 30 or 40K, or Alpine, subalpine, and it's just unreal. And then you descend into the Stein Valley and you sort of follow the outflow of the watershed there for 60 some K. To Lytton, and that is like, it's amazing. But there's so much deadfall, and like there's been a bunch of burns through there, so like the way it's regrown and everything, it's a smash. But there's in Matt Gunn's scramble book, like the book for BC, there's mm-hmm. 8 scrambles in that area. And so I got it in my head, I'm like, okay, I went on Strava and I mapped it around, I'm like, okay, we can do all 8 scrambles and the Stein Valley, the 100K in like basically 2 nights 3 days. And so we go out and do the first one, Shields Peak, which is way out of the way.
This is going to be a 3-day trip?
3-day trip is what we, 2 nights, 3 days. Fast. So we have like our, so we're thinking like we're going to do probably about 50K a day.
Okay.
Which seemed, and then so after we go out to Shields Peak, which is like, it's the only part of the, where you had to really deviate off the main trail. Like you had to backtrack a ton and you had to do this bushwhack. And so we climbed onto it, and then we're like, oh, this is taking quite a bit of time. I was way more technical than we had kind of than I had anticipated. But then we're coming back to the main trail, and we're doing this like bushwhack, and had to do this tight squeeze, and I squeezed through it, and I hear the sound of compressed gas going off, and I'm thinking to myself, like, what the hell is that? I don't know what that is. Like, in that split second, like, I don't have compressed gas, so I look underneath my arm, and the Bear Mace safety had come off, and it was facing forward, and it went, the full stream went right into my face. I knew instantly what had happened. I'd like literally Bear Maced myself in the face. So, you know, I spent the next half an hour sitting there just like waiting it so I could at least kind of open my eyes a little bit. And thank God we were like almost out of the bushwhack and into the alpine, and there was a tarn right there. So I just went and put my face in it, and I was okay after about an hour or something. But the thing is, like, it's really oil based. So I got into my back and my skin, and it was just like on fire. So this is about like, I don't know, maybe this is 5 hours, 13K into the 100 and some K. So from there, we just sort of deviated back on the trail and just continued on the trail. We like axed all the, and even still, what I had forecasted for us to do would have taken like, that was the understatement and the under forecast of like, like bit off way more. Like you're looking at what I was planning, like where you can Google Maps so much and like look at it. And like Strava was told me that if we did, you know, that schedule, that it would be, the first day would have been like 45K and about 5,000 meters a gain, which is lots, but it's doable. But really, like in hindsight, we were already at like 44K with only doing one of them and at like 23 or 2400 meters. So like realistically, it would have been way, way more.
So, did you guys finish the trip?
Yeah. So, I mean, I just like manned up and just kind of like kept on going. And it was like the second day, you know, you're in this baking down sun, and it felt like I had such huge, cause it was in the late August. So it was really hot. I felt like I just had like chemical burns in my, it was awful.
So it was still burning the second day.
Oh, it was burning the third, the fourth day. Like I could still feel it. Like it was not,
in your eyes, not on
my
eyes.
No, my face was all good. My face, cause I rinsed it so thoroughly, was fine. It was like where it had stepped into, like it looked like dripped down my back and like in the, under my arm and everything, that was just like on fire. It's just nasty stuff. Like part of me is kind of, you know, I'm kind of happy now that I know what it feels like, what Bear Mace feels like. But at the other time, I think I'm good. I don't need to feel that again.
Jesus, for 4 days you were feeling this.
Oh, yeah, even like the days after, yeah, we'll shower everything. Like you could still feel it, like the tingly, yeah. It definitely got less and less intense as each day went on. But the next 2 days like were dark times. Because we were still running like 45K, you know, with 2,000 meter plus each day.
Through like rugged terrain.
Yeah, and you're packs. And you're fast packing. So you're not like up with a tiny little backpack. Like I had a tent and like a sleeping bag and stuff. So, you know.
20 pound pack, 15 pound
less,
pack?
Less. So I was under 20 pounds, everything fully loaded with water.
So you didn't have any climbing gear. It was all scrambling?
All scrambling. Yeah, didn't even bring a helmet. Which, I mean, in hindsight, because the book said most of them were easy. There was one that was considered moderate. I feel like I've got a fairly good, handle on what that means. But no, the way we went up, like helmet would have been good. There was a lot of loose stuff. It was pretty rotten. So,
and how many people were there?
Four of us.
Four.
Yeah, it's a good squad. But yeah, we just ended up, you know, we just ended up keep going. It was just long days. I mean, and it was a lot of like deadfall. But it's crazy because it's so beautiful. And it's, I mean, I'd recommend anyone go and do that one. That one's like that's cooler than the West Coast Trail for sure. Like just Google Tundra Lake. Like look at Tundra Lake, and it is insane. It is this weird color of blue that I've never seen in nature ever before, and it's part of it.
Like the blue Gatorade kind of water.
Yeah, it's like this really dark, I think emerald is maybe the color. It's this dark blue. It's really weird. I don't know why it's that color, but it's insane. It's so beautiful. And then the whole outflow, it's like it has like a magical feel to it. It's really, really cool. Like unlike anything I've ever really done, especially in BC. And
So this was a point A to point B trip.
Yep.
And then you guys were just going to do these out and back arms off these three extra scrambles.
So there's eight in the area. So we did one of the eight, which my buddies always make fun of me for like having this plan of, oh, we're going to do it all. Cause then I'm like pointing when we're out there, like when we're
you're the guy everyone wants. Cause you're the guy that plans the epic trips and comes back with the ridiculous stories. But, you
know, like, yeah, this is too much. It was, I mean, looking at it, it was very ambitious. Very, very ambitious. If you went there and you threw another couple days in there, then yeah, you could go do it for sure. But But to try to do what we were doing, like, or try to do what I thought that was doable, it was definitely not for me anyways. Like, somebody, there's people probably that live in Squamish that could do that.
You're running ultra marathons through, like, the rugged terrain day after day with packs on your back, climbing up mountains, and you bear maced yourself 8K to the first one. That's epic, man. That's crazy. Yeah, I
totally bear maced myself in the face. But it was awesome. It's great. I recommend anyone do that. The Stein Valley is so cool.
Man, like, when people ask me, what am I planning for after the cycling? It's like, this is what I'm planning. This is sounds pretty good.
Totally. It's so cool.
That's crazy, man. And so I guess where a lot of guys would know you from is, or like at least in the cycling world, like the current generation would know you from this epic trip you did with Rob.
Yeah.
The bikepacking to Worlds trip Rob Britton did with you guys. Do you want to just give us like the background story on that?
Yeah, he just like sent an email to the Blue. So he's kind of got, Rob's got like his cycling friends, but then he's kind of got his old like friends from way beyond that are kind of like maybe his, I'd say his like kind of his real friends. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he's got this list of, we have like an Instagram group together that's like a group chat that's always going. And he just put it to us, I'm thinking of doing this. I think he was bored in a hotel room once, like, you know how it gets. And started planning this fantasy trip from Calgary to, because Calgary, his fiance was doing her, finishing med school in Calgary. So Rob had to move to Calgary. Like, you know, he's a good fiance. So he moved there for sure. I think, you don't think it was his first choice, but he did. And he planned this trip to Port Renfrew because he does this like gravel ride there every year. And I just saw it and I was like, oh, that sounds like something I'd be into. And the timing worked, so it was pretty cool. But just like jumped right in. I literally, like, my first ride on my gravel bike with all my bags loaded on it, packed down, was this first day of that bike packing trip. Like, I remember just like riding it away from my parents' house because I grew up in Calgary also. And so the way it worked is I grew up in the south and Rob was living in the north. So instead of meeting in the middle and then leaving the city together, we sort of both left from our, and then met at sort of we met at like 40K outside of the city. So we didn't have to do any backtracking. So those first like kind of hour and a half, 2 hours by ourselves, we were both just like, I guess this is bike. You're like trying to pilot this 60-pound bike with all this stuff.
Sure, sure.
But it just turned out to be like the best trip ever. I mean, it didn't really crack. It was all just like long days of, and Rob just had the route so dialed. He's pretty like savanty like that. He can kind of like,
did he plan it all?
Yeah, I didn't even know where we were going ever, and he just had like two Garmins and like kept us off highways with almost the entire way. And a lot of us following that Trans-Canada trail, so we're going over and we were following, like, we were on like the Kettle Valley Railway for a bit. We were on like tons of like really nice logging roads. Yeah, it was super cool. So yeah, we went Calgary to Elkford, which is like right into the heart of the Rocky Mountains. Elkford to Cranbrook through Fernie, which was super, super cool on the second day. And then we went from Cranbrook to Nelson, which was awesome. Had to ride a ferry and it's super, super cool. Fernie to Christina Lake. Again, like that was mostly on railroad passes and stuff. We went Christina Lake, we went to Merritt. And so on that day, we picked up, Caramias. We picked up another guy, my buddy Taylor. He was like on his first year honeymoon.
In great way to spend it with the guys.
Yeah, so he couldn't start the whole thing with us. So he did that one. And then from there, we went to Merritt, Merritt to Lillooet, Lillooet to Squamish, stayed at my house in Squamish, and then Squamish to Port Renfrew. And yeah, it was just like a good quality day. Like there was nothing really like insane about it. Like the only day that was really, really epic was day two, because we had to do like a 3-hour hike a bike. So, you know, it was like, and none of us really knew what we were getting into. And so that
we were in road shoes, or did you like transfer
mountain bike shoes? I was wearing mountain bike shoes the whole time.
Did you do the 3-hour hike a bike in mountain bike shoes? Or just like, let's
mountain bike shoes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know,
was it up a logging road, or
it was up a very decommissioned logging road.
Okay.
And so you get to the top and, yeah, and it's like you've done, so it took us 3 hours and we'd only done like under 20K. And then you're like, that was like over a 200K day. And you're like looking at the time we started.
Wait, it took you how long that day?
I don't know how long we were like, the time we probably left at 10 in the morning and finished at like, I don't know, 11 at night. Oh, so we roll into Cranbrook and we're like, we're all stoked because we're like, okay, this is a hotel night. We weren't camping this night. So we rock up there and we like start going to hotels and it's like full. This one's full. This one's full.
Oh, no.
We're like, geez, what's going on here? So like, I call this one and they're like, okay, they refer me to another one, which is like the high end one in there. And they tell us that what's going on is it's BC Masters Games going on.
What is that?
I don't know. It's like BC. It's just like older people doing games. Yeah. So
board games.
Well, I don't know what they meant. I thought it might be like curling or winter games or something like that. So, but that's not kind of what happened later. Well, in Cranbrook, I don't know. So we ended up getting a theme room at this hotel, and it was like New York theme. So it had a jacuzzi tub and like this crazy bed and all this New York theme wallpaper. So we took all our gritty, dirty, because it had pissed down rain that day, all our clothes, put it in this friggin' hot tub. That was like a heart-shaped hot tub, like straight out of Dumb and Dumber, pretty much. And we like just got these dirty chamois in there, and like throwing soap in it and putting the jets soup on.
Yeah. Oh, you guys are horrible.
But then we, whatever. That was expensive because it was a theme room. But then like 2 days later, we're on the ferry. Rob and I are on the ferry to like crossing Kootenay Lake, and we meet these two people that are like, "Oh, you got bikes?" And they're asking us, and we're like, "Well, where are you coming from?" They were coming from BC Masters Games. Yeah, she lost. The woman we were talking to lost in the cribbage final of BC Masters
Games. The what? The final?
Cribbage, like the card game.
It's a card game.
Yeah, it's a card game. She lost in the final. So we're like, oh, that's what BC Masters Games is. It was like card games and stuff. So we found it out like 2 days later just by running into someone that was at BC Masters Games.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous, man.
So yeah, it was pretty funny. And then yeah, Rob kept the safety on. He just did massive volume until the climb out of Lillooet on the Duffy there.
Yeah, yeah.
He kind of just started riding as hard as he could until my buddy Taylor and I just blew to the moon and just sort of didn't really tell us. Just, and that was the only bit of that happened. And other than that, it was smooth sailing.
That's funny because I dragged Carl constantly.
Oh yeah,
in our ridiculous bike trip. Yeah, like 287-kilometer bike trip from Cache Creek to Squamish in a day. I dragged him into that, and we got to that section at the base of it. And Carl had like been through the area like once or twice before, like hitchhiking on his way to ski touring trips, but wasn't familiar with it. We got to that part of the base of the climb, and I didn't know that was it. Like, it didn't stand out. Like, I knew it was coming around. We got to that point, there's like a bridge right at the bottom there, and he's just like, "This is the point where Rob dropped Jamie," and then yeah, Jamie told me that, as if Jamie's just been giving him horror stories and whatnot. He's like, "You better not do that to me." I was just like, "Of course, this is the one part you remember about totally. This. Jamie's just been telling you horror stories about this mountain we gotta climb." Yeah. Out of here.
That was awful, but yeah, the rest of the trip, that was so good.
But it's such a crazy story too, because like, this is Rob preparing to go to the World Championships, where Mike Woods ended up podiuming.
And also Rob was in the breakaway
all day.
Yeah, all day, like over 200K. He was like one of the fourth last guy from that breakaway to survive.
So this is his training for the World Championships. And you guys are just like, "Yeah, sure, I can get the week off work. Let's go do this bike packing trip." But at the same time, you guys just got to be like the golden retriever. It's just like, Rob's like, "You guys want to go for a walk?" Be like, "Yep, absolutely, let's go."
Yeah, it was awesome. I had to do zero planning. The only thing I had to do was buy a bike and bags and then get a plane ticket to Calgary. And then other than that, I mean, every campground, everything was like completely mapped out, taken care of. Every night we always had like good food, you know, we'd go, and by good food, I mean, we'd go like eat burgers or like whatever beer, and we'd have like a couple beers at least.
How many nights did you camp?
We camped, so we spent the night twice in a hotel, so 9 days. Everything else was camping.
That's brutal, like logging some huge days and then sleeping on sleeping pads.
Which wasn't that bad. Like, I mean, once you get your tent, like, I mean, I slept in a tent tons, but like freaking tent gear is so good now that, you know, I don't know. I had no problem sleeping in my tent.
But when you're sweaty and gross and your kit's just disgusting and like, really?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it wasn't raining tons, so, and it's so dry in the Rockies that you just get there and you have like a bird bath, and then you're in your nice, dry, comfortable clothes because you have it with you. You kind of like, whatever, turn your chamois on inside out and air it out, and next day just put tons of sham cream on. And then like, we were able to do a laundry a couple times.
Gnarly. Jesus. Oh.
Yeah, so it's... Man. Yeah, I guess it would. But I don't know. I feel like, on the flip side, that when you're doing like a fast pack or hike, you're like way more, you're dirtbagging it way more. Like this, you're not even cooking. Like, you know, you get changed in your warm clothes and you wander over to the pub and like smash a burger and a beer. You're not like trying to fire up your little stove and like warm up your dehydrated meal or something.
That's true. Yeah. Like warming up a dehydrated meal when you're just like freezing out in the middle of nowhere. But when you have like a burger, burrito, beer, pizza, at the end of it.
We always kind of found something. There was one night when we rolled in and like they had nothing, like their kitchen had shut down. Well, I just begged, we begged the server and she like, we just ordered everything off Appy's menus. And then we all crushed like one of those small things that Ben and Jerry's after do. So
that's awesome, man. That's a really cool trip. Yeah, okay. So last question I kind of want to ask you is from cycling, from all the years you've been on this planet, what are three to, let's say, eight things that, so five things, three things, eight things, whatever you want, can be like specific items of things that are just like, if it's an item, it could be like, I would have bought that twice over, or like it could be like an item, a book, a course, a quote, a class, like just specific items, anything like that. Like for me, I would recommend, like, everybody owns a Leatherman. I really love Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell would be a book. I think everybody has to see the movie Goodfellas. Like, you know, what are some of the things? Is there any items that stand out for you? You know, like I did a podcast with Carl, and like he was talking about like the sweet headlamp he has in one. Like, we're such gear junkies with all the mount stuff, but it doesn't have to be gear or anything like that. Is there any sort of like specific items where like you could pass this down to your kids? This is, I want you to have this or know this or read this.
Yeah, I guess it'd be more like, I think it would probably be like some different guidebooks. So I really like, you know, especially for around here, the Scrambles of Southwest BC is a super rad one. You know, that's one that it's sort of like a gear item, but at the same time, it's more experience, you know? And I guess it has changed a ton, but maybe like take my edited version of that with like little notes in it, and that thing would be pretty sweet for as long. Yeah. Spot WX, the website, is one that I wish that I knew back in the day that I use every day now. I don't know if you know that one where you can like pinpoint exactly, and you can see like precipitation accumulation, like wind, and it's like pretty accurate, and there's like tons of different modeling on it, so you can do that, and it's so applicable for doing anything outside.
Okay, so like that's Spot WRX,
spotwx.com.
okay,
so it's really good if you're like trying to like, especially for skiing, if you want to go look at
it. Is it the same as like the spot, like the
spots? No, it's just a weather modeling website.
It's a weather app.
Yeah, it's like a website. So they don't have an app. It's just like web based. So
okay,
if you go there, you can like look, like you can click on a specific point on a like a topo map, and it'll tell you, you know, it'll give you an idea as to where the freezing level's at. If it's going to snow, how much is going to accumulate over...
Oh, this is great for every outdoor athlete.
Yeah, yeah. It's super, super good. You know.
Spot WX.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah,
that one's great, for sure. That one's super, super good. Carl's is a headlamp, hey?
Well, you know, it's funny what you said, because he said a headlamp and John Baldwin's Ski Touring the Coast Mountains book, and you say the Scrambles book, and those are the two guidebooks I have.
Those are great. But the other one too, like, is so I really like, because I went to the university in University of Victoria on the island, and the island alpine feels like it's a little more untouched than the stuff out here. There's less hustle and bustle, and it's super amazing. So I'd say like the guy who wrote the, it's not really a Scrambles book, it's a climbing book, although there's scrambles in it, the Philip Stone Island Alpine.
Okay.
Or the Island Alpine Select. That's another super great book, because the stuff there is awesome. I love the island. It's amazing. So that's another super cool little gem that I would like to pass along for sure, because I don't know, that's sort of where I started to transition from cycling to doing outdoor stuff, is when I was living on the island, and that's kind of where I really, really kind of fell in love with it. And that's, it's awesome there. It's different, but it's really cool.
Sweet, man. That's awesome. Dude, I really enjoyed telling all these stories. That was fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. Well, hopefully everyone else enjoyed some of the stories.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed some of those stories with Jamie. He's a pretty rad dude, and just looking at his life right now, that gives me something to look forward to after cycling. And just knowing just the fun stuff he gets to do all the time when he doesn't have to be super focused on his weight. And I'm no stranger to going out for an epic day out on the trails or on the bike. And you're just coming home, you're wrecked, you're on your way back to the trailhead, you're just falling down the mountain, just can't wait to get back to the truck. And on your way to the local place to grab a burrito, a couple beers, and just hang out with your buddies after an epic day out there. Everyone who's ever been in a ski town or comes from a ski town knows when you're at the local pub, bar, wherever the local watering hole is, and you can just see the guys and girls that have just come off the mountain, They probably smell really bad, but in a town full of dirtbags, just out enjoying it and maxing their days, having fun, starting with a headlamp, finishing with a headlamp, up before the sun's up, first up on the hill, last chair, everything. Earn your turns. Those are the guys that are out maxing their days and just collapsing at the local watering hole at the end of the day. That, to me, that's the dream life. A life outside. The more time I can spend outside, the better. So it gives me something to look forward to. The next episode coming up is a really cool one. It's Ian Boswell. Ian is one of the best cyclists the U.S. has ever produced. Ian has recently retired from pro racing. He worked his way right up to the top. At one point, he rode for Team Sky, which is, if you're not, I'm imagining everyone's familiar with that, but if not, they are the New York Yankees of pro cycling. Ian rode for them for several seasons, then with Katusha Alpecin, and ended his career at the end of 2019 due to some head injuries that he sustained there. So Ian is one of the nicest, most humble, and well-spoken guys in the pro peloton, and I was so fortunate to have this conversation with him. I'm sure you're going to love that one. That's coming up next week. Hope you enjoyed Jamie. If you're interested in following me anymore, you can always do so at jackburkcycling.com or jackflash66 on Instagram. All right. Have a good one, everybody.